Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we meet a software developer whose pile of insurance denials led her to create a new use for AI.
And we will also meet a seeker from Michigan who helped popularize a warped version of Hopi spirituality.
But first, the CHIPS Act has had a major economic impact in Arizona, bringing major companies like Intel and the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company here to build massive facilities and bring thousands of jobs to manufacture semiconductor chips. Lawmakers did it by offering them generous tax credits and subsidies to come. The same has been true around the country, where chip manufacturers have invested billions in similar plants. Now, President Biden is poised to sign a bill that proponents say will make that even easier. The bill weakens federal environmental reviews for certain semiconductor projects to get them off the ground faster. The National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, process is a notoriously lengthy one that will soon be fast-tracked for companies that received the CHIPS Act subsidies. The bill unanimously passed the Senate last year, and the House passed it just last week, but not without objections from some Democrats, like environmental hawk and longtime Arizona lawmaker Raul Grijalva. But our first guest this morning says today's semiconductor plants are not those of the 1950s. Chris Camacho is president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council and a proponent of the CHIPS Act. I spoke with him more about it earlier this morning.
Well, I think as this bill moved swiftly and unanimously through the Senate, there was a lot of discussion about the importance of moving through the NEPA process expeditiously. There are over $450 billion of investment that have been made in the last 3 years tied to the CHIPS and Science Act across 28 states. So we're excited about moving through this NEPA process in accelerated form, and I think it's going to be good for the country in terms of critical defense positioning.
Okay, so let's talk about, before we talk about the environmental aspect of this, first just tell us a little bit about the impact that the CHIPS Act has had here in Arizona so far. It's been big, like the numbers are big, right?
I don't know that we've seen this kind of investment scale and scope in Arizona's history. We've had over $135 billion of investment made in the semiconductor sector. And since 2020, 40 companies have made announcements to launch facilities here. And now, naturally, the mainstays, TSMC and Intel, get a lot of the acclaim, but companies like Amkor and their advanced packaging facility, as well as ASM and their capital equipment manufacturing, which was announced a few weeks ago in Scottsdale, this is really having regional and statewide impact with thousands of jobs. And this is a really important time for our state as we continue to diversify our economic position.
Okay, so let's talk about the environmental aspect here. This particular bill the president is expected to sign soon would make that process faster. It is a notoriously long process. Have we seen that environmental review process hinder production here in terms of the semiconductor industry?
Well, there are a lot of concerns when you're talking about these kind of billion-dollar fabs that are producing chips that go into a number of our defense sector's important projects and products. And at the same time, the scale and speed in which they need to operate has historically been a challenge. And so this NEPA process on average can take anywhere from 4 to 5 years of environmental reviews. And in our world, time kills deals, time kills projects. And while we want to maintain alignment with the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, which this bill will require, we want to ensure that an expeditious move of this kind of investment happens. And I can tell you that these kind of firms are investing in Asia, they're investing all over the world, and we want to ensure that the United States is a very competitive position as well.
Okay. What are the long-term impacts of that? Like if these environmental review processes do sort of kill deals, as you're saying here, like what could that mean for the broader industry?
Well, you know, capital goes where it's welcomed and accepted. And again, the alignment with, again, the standard Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, those laws are going to be abided by. This just accelerates the process to move through this NEPA review with all of these federal agencies that have oversight of that process. We believe this is going to move these companies to make more investments faster, and at the same time shore up these critical national defense assets that we have and that we need going forward.
So the bill was bipartisan, unanimous in the Senate, but it did not come without criticism. Senator Mark Kelly obviously was a big supporter of it. He was a co-sponsor of the original bill, the CHIPS Act. But Representative Raul Grijalva from Arizona here, the top Democrat on the Natural Resources Committee, has called it unconscionable. Like, there are concerns about the semiconductor industry's history of leaving behind Superfund sites, like the impact on the communities where they're built. I wonder, like, do you think those kinds of concerns have been balanced enough in this legislation?
Well, one thing I have observed very directly with this new age of semiconductor investments, very different than what you saw in the 50s and 60s and 70s in the United States. Companies like TSMC have made it public. They're no longer going to use specific environmentally hazardous chemicals like NMP or PFAS, which are very well known out in the environmental community. So there's commitments there. There's commitments by companies like Intel that continue to invest in Arizona's watershed. So these companies, largely by the influence of their stakeholders, are becoming or had become much more environmentally conscious and friendly. And in many respects are now the kind of stewards of the environment as they're creating these jobs and making these investments. So, everything's a balance, but I think this is a great bipartisan bill. Kudos to Senator Kelly and his leadership. He and I have traveled around the world working with the semiconductor companies and actively listened to what they prioritize. And again, I think this finds a bipartisan balance in getting a really strong piece of legislation through that will not only secure our foundational defense position, but also drive significant number of jobs for Americans. And again, for Arizona specifically, 40 companies adding tens of thousands of supply chain jobs in Arizona. I don't know of a period in time where we've seen this kind of intense investment and job creation in our state.
Are we trusting the companies themselves there essentially to police themselves when it comes to these environmental regulations then?
Well, I think specifically on the Clean Air Act in terms of VOCs and NOx emissions, as well as TDS and the water lines, the Clean Air Act and clean the water standards are going to enforce or ensure that the public has visibility to the kind of discharge that they have for their facilities and or the kind of air emissions that these companies would have. They're going to have to still abide by the current laws on the book. So we feel very confident in what these companies' plans are going forward.
Last question for you, Chris. I mean, you're interested in economic development for the state, right? So quality of life has to obviously be a part of that. Do you think broadly environmental concerns like these are a part of that calculation when we're talking about major development, major industry like this?
Well, it is always a balance. And what I can tell you too is, unfortunately, the manufacturing industry gets the stigma of smokestacks and poor air quality. And that was your 1950s, steel worker, steel manufacturing, back east. These facilities are modern, they're clean, they're state of the art. They really are a different image of what many people think manufacturing is. And I've traveled around the world, all over Western Europe to Asia, and then our domestic locations of these factories. And they are high-tech, clean manufacturing with billions of dollars of new state-of-the-art capital equipment invested in them, not just the four walls, that secure them. So, I'm excited about the impacts of the semiconductor sector. And going forward, Arizona is going to continue to be known as Semiconductor Central. And these kind of accelerated pathways to move through a NEPA process is vital for our ability to compete globally for these kind of investments.
All right. Chris Camacho, president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, joining us. Chris, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And now to a story about a use for AI that goes beyond writing high school English papers or pickup lines on dating apps.
Holden Caro is not from the United States. A trans woman from Canada, she was surprised, and not in a good way, when she first had to navigate the U.S. healthcare system. She says she received a string of insurance denials as she sought care. At first, she thought it was just because she was seeking gender-affirming care, but then she got hit by a car and realized this is a problem just about anyone can face. So Caro did something about it. The software developer used her programming skills to help other people do something she had become pretty good at. A appeal health insurance denials. And she did it using AI. The result is a website called fighthealthinsurance.com, where anyone can go to get AI to help them write their health insurance appeal. I spoke with Caro more about it, beginning with her first introduction to the American healthcare world.
So it started off very confusing. And in fact, the first time I went to a doctor's office in America, I remember being asked for my visa and just being super confused and thinking they wanted to know my immigration status. and then things just kind of got worse from there. You get lots of denials. Initially, I thought it was just because I was trying to access gender-affirming care. And at the time, that was maybe like not a super common thing for people to do. And so I figured, you know, maybe this is just, you know, a corner case of the American healthcare system, and it works normally for other people. But later on, that very clearly became not the case.
Right. And then you get hit by a car, right? Like, and things got even crazier.
They did. Yeah. So in 2019, I got hit by a car. You know, there's, of course, the initial shock, like, okay, I broke my bones, like everything hurts. Oh, dear God. How do I survive? But then I'd say, like, within, like, you know, several hours of being hit by a car, it was like, okay, I remember reading an article about the hospital that the ambulance brought me to. They're not in network with anyone. And this is the only tier one trauma center in San Francisco. And it's just like, okay, well, probably where I need to go. But like, this is also going to be super, like, super annoying to deal with. I remember still like being high on the painkillers that they were giving me, trying to figure out health insurance.
So it sounds like you spent a lot of time after all of this happened, like fighting insurance claims that were denied. Did you win? How'd it go?
Yeah, so I won most of them, which is super exciting.
Right.
And to be clear, also not normal, right? and like, I would also say that I frequently would go to like unreasonable lengths. So I remember like I was at one company and they didn't want to pay for certain stuff for me or some other folks who I talked to. And I was like, okay, so like this is a company that clearly cares about their public image and they care about being seen as like, you know, a queer friendly employer, right? Like they put in all this effort. But on the other hand, like also this is at the second level of denial. The next level of appeal for this kind of health insurance plan is you sue them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so if I sue you, this will be public and I'm fine doing that. Most people are not particularly willing to take their employer to court over, you know, not huge amounts of money. But
right.
I was kind of just like, this is really wrong and I'm really annoyed with you. So like, I will sue you because I'm, you know, not a lawyer, but it looks like I will probably only be responsible for my costs if I lose.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't have a lot to lose here, whereas you have a lot to lose. So like, would you want to consider like maybe, you know, changing things? And they actually, like, I'm really happy about that outcome eventually, because not only did I get them to like cover it, I actually got them to change some of how the policy worked.
Wow.
For people going forward. And that's where I was like, oh man, I can actually, like, you know, by being completely unreasonable, as the saying goes, I can force the world to change in small little bits.
That's amazing, though. That's amazing. So, okay. So, right. You're a software developer also, like in your day job.
Yes.
So you have this issue that you've been through. You understand that you can make a change here and you decide to kind of do it and do it on a level that is accessible to everybody. And you find this really great use for AI. You trained AI to help people write their health insurance appeals. So tell us about Fight Health Insurance here.
Totally. So I think a lot of the uses of AI are perhaps not super fantastic. And that's as much as I'll say, because I want to continue to be employable in the Bay Area. But like, yeah, I think this is a pretty good use case, because like insurance letters are something that most people have very limited experience writing. And you have to write them in certain ways for them to like take you seriously at all, right? But then the problem is, for most AI, right, like what you really want is you want a lot of examples of it going well, right?
Right.
So you want a lot of insurance denials, and then you want a lot of successful insurance appeals. And the problem is, the people who have that are the insurance companies. And the insurance companies weren't exactly excited to share information with me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, okay, well, that's a challenge. How do I... how do I find information so that I can make this model? And so I looked around a bunch, and then the state of California, we have an independent medical review board, and our independent medical review board actually publishes their decisions. And that is fantastic,
right?
Because it means that you've got all of this information about, like, hey, this is a thing that an insurance company denied. This is why the person appealed it, and this is why we either approved or rejected that appeal. That is the information that you want. And then we have this data set, we train a model, and so the first model that I train on this data set isn't great. Get back to my day job for a while,
right?
Another health insurance company, technically pet health insurance, denies my pet's health insurance claim. And I'm like, no, this is a bridge too far. I am going back to my project and I'm finishing it.
Wow. So it was your dog's health insurance that really set you over the edge here. Okay.
Yeah, that was the final push.
So you train this AI to do this very specific thing by finding this very specific data set, right? And working with that. Because you know, health insurance appeal is very specific. Are you essentially like using their own language here to help people write their appeals?
Very much so. So it's very much using the language of, they're called second or third level appeals, depending on the plan, but using that kind of language to produce the right kind of things. Fundamentally, like most people, I think most people know why they need the medicine, but they don't know how to say it right.
Right.
Like, I know that I need to take my hormones. That is apparently like not sufficient medical justification. So instead you have to say, like, according to the standards of care, like this revision, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Okay. So this is pretty new, but how is this going? Like, have people been successful so far in getting these denials reversed?
So the majority of the people that I've talked to so far are like, hey, I submitted my appeal, but the insurance company has not gotten back to me yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one person who was like, yeah, no dice. They got back to me and said no. But then there was another person who got back to me and was like, yeah, they said yes. And actually the person who said yes was not their insurance company. It was the Department of Managed Care. And so that's like a second level external appeal. And so their insurance company had said no, but then they wrote the appeal to the state, and the state said yes. And that was, I don't know. That was the happiest email I got that day. It's not going to change the world yet, but I have this like dream of, we make it so that it costs the insurance companies more to deny care, so they do it less often. And that might not be a reasonable dream, but it is my dream.
All right, we'll leave it there then. Holden Caro, creator of Fight Health Insurance, joining us. Holden, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us your story here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the time.
Good morning. You are listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, breeze blocks are both decorative and functional.
The breeze block is really to let in breeze and daylight, but it is a really nice screening, privacy screening as well. So that is often how mid-century modern architects used decorative block.
At one point in time, Phoenix was the concrete block capital of the U.S. We'll hear from a Valley architect about their legacy.
But first, how much do you know about the religion of the Hopi? Unless you yourself are Hopi, the answer is probably not as much as you think. All over the world, and particularly here in the Southwest, the Hopi people have come to symbolize a deep spirituality. Many see them as prophets of impending doom, keepers of sacred truths that have the power to cast out evil and remake the world. The problem is that this version of the Hopi religion was largely popularized by non-Hopi people. In the 1930s and 40s, a faction of the Hopi split off from the rest of the community and declared themselves to be the keepers of the quote-unquote true Hopi tradition. Before long, these so-called traditionalists attracted the attention of disaffected white people searching for meaning. And that, according to cultural anthropologist Brian Haley, is where the problem started. In his new book, Hopis and the Counterculture, Haley tells the story of the seekers who latched on to the traditionalist faction of the Hopi, including people like Craig Carpenter.
He was a young man who had left his home in Michigan in the 1940s and come out to California, seeking an answer to the question of, is civilization right or wrong. Very spiritually oriented, very metaphysical kind of guy who was into a variety of different religious forms that at the time were referred to sort of collectively as the occult, but really are the forerunners of modern spirituality, which sometimes is glossed as the New Age. He met with and joined this Hopi faction in 1955 and also sort of transformed himself into a Mohawk Indian through this same process of working with these people.
So he adopted a story for himself of having such ancestry, even though he did not actually have it.
He's one of a number of people who joined in this movement who had this exact same characteristic of Neo-Indianism.
At this point in the story, though, folks like Carpenter have found their way to this group of so-called traditionalists amongst the Hopi, and they're very interested in the ways that it rhymes with their own ideas. But there comes a point in the 60s where these notions start to rhyme with the sort of bubbling countercultural energy of the early Vietnam era. How did that happen?
It's interesting because Carpenter took this minority view that civilization was messed up and that so-called primitive societies offered something better. By the mid-60s, that idea had gained a lot of headway and was becoming much more popular in the emerging counterculture that became the hippies. And there was another individual who was important here. That's the Southwest writer Frank Waters, who had also reinvented himself as an Indian to give his work greater authority. He had joined with Oswald White Bear Fredericks on the Hopi Reservation to write Book of the Hopi, which initially essentially was going to tell the traditionalist faction's version of Hopi tradition. Waters didn't understand the politics there at all. It was published in the early 60s and became available and widely available. It's now available in like 7 languages.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, it sort of became a fixture of bookshelves in those New Age spiritual communities.
Very much so.
Were popping
Very
up at this
so.
Time, right?
So it was, The direct link into the hippie movement occurs in Los Angeles in late 1966, where you have a radio show on KPFK, public radio in Los Angeles.
This is my favorite part of the story.
Yeah, this is your favorite part of the story, of course. Radio Free Oz was a late night call-in talk radio show that was just exclusively counterculture.
I think it's a little bit fitting that we were talking about the astral plane tonight, because one of the things that Swami Panchadasi gets into is inspiration, and he has a beautiful tiny little paragraph on it, which he says...
Well, one evening, they were chatting on the air about Book of the Hopi. A friend of Craig Carpenter's heard this. He was living in Los Angeles at the time, and they brought him to the studio and introduced them all and so forth. And the Radio Free Oz broadcast then started doing a number of radio documentaries that gave the Hopi traditionalist faction's view of things without any real significant critique of what was actually going on there.
So if I'm hearing you right, this is a moment in the story where this version of Hopi religion that has been transformed by a faction of the Hopi community and some self-interested parties from outside the community basically receives this giant media megaphone at a time when there's a great hunger in broader American culture for ideas like this. And if I understand the implications of the book correctly, that has resulted in a broad misunderstanding of the true breadth of Hopi spirituality that persists kind of to this day, right?
Yes, and of Native politics as well. The Hopi people have been kind of plagued by their popularity among these spiritual seekers who come and want answers to very cosmological questions. They come
right.
and they sometimes
is society bad?
Right. They come and interfere in ceremonies sometimes. They have damaged shrine sites. They have established shrine sites of their own on the reservation. Mm. The popularity of Frank Waters' Book of the Hopi, for instance, was so great that the bookstore on the Hopi Reservation at their cultural center had to stock it because so many people asked for it all the time and they needed the money.
Right.
And this contributed to a generation of Hopi youth growing up thinking the book was accurate.
Yeah. Well, and we should say that you're sort of breaking news here, right? I mean, to quote from the book, you actually say, quote, "No chronicler has recognized the Neo-Indian presence in the Hopi traditionalist faction's network or its implications for what is perceived as American Indian, quote, tradition in various Native and non-Native communities."
Yeah, and I think that's a real important part of the book. Where did this huge fascination with Native Americans suddenly become a movement of non-Native people claiming Native identity? What I've done here in this book is discover one of the major pathways to the popularization of Native American identity among people who really don't have that background.
And before we move off the radio element of this conversation, my fellow radio nerds may or may not be aware that Radio Free Oz ended up becoming the Firesign Theater, which people may know a little bit better.
Yes. And the interesting thing about their involvement, as they were developing their recordings, they began to see the appropriation that was taking place by the counterculture, the appropriation of Native American ideas and culture. And they backed away. And they are the only major figures in the book who made that breakthrough. And it is much to their credit.
Well, if folks listening want to find out more about all of this, they should read Professor Haley's book, Hopis and the Counterculture. And Professor Haley is a professor of cultural anthropology at SUNY Oneonta. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Earlier this year, an essay appeared in The Atlantic with a provocative title, "Dear Therapist, I Don't Want to Take Care of My Aging Homophobic Parents." The piece was fueled by a thorny question. When it comes to caregiving, especially at the end of life, what do we owe parents who caused us extreme pain and trauma? The piece got us talking here at the office, and we decided to see what a therapist had to say about it. So I sat down with Joshua Johnson, a therapist and social worker at Bridge Consulting Services in Phoenix. He told me that when it comes to parental relationships, his patients often feel intense social pressure to put their pain aside. But Johnson says that can be an unhealthy thing to do.
Sometimes you do have to create some distance to heal. And in order for you to heal, sometimes you have to kind of turn off the noise in other arenas so you can kind of, you know, navigate into your self-care space and really start healing the inner child in you. And then hopefully then you get to a point where now you're able to bring them back into the fold, right? But by that time, you've not only acknowledged the trauma, but then now you've learned how to set boundaries with it.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel like we're talking about a bit of a taboo here, this idea
right.
that you would separate, quote unquote, from your parents willingly.
Right.
Can you maybe give any examples that might illustrate why that can be valuable for somebody who is reckoning with abuse or something like that?
Absolutely. They learn forgiveness. They learn not only forgiveness towards the person who hurt them, right? But they also learn forgiveness within themselves, because oftentimes when we have been abused, you know, we end up blaming ourselves. And one of the biggest things I have to remember and teach people is that when this abuse happened, you were 6, 7, 8, 10, 16 years old, right? So you, clearly, right, you don't have the cognitive thought process of understanding that this was abuse until now we're in this space as an adult.
So when it comes to this sense of forgiveness, how much do you find, I guess, that your clients are struggling to forgive themselves for a situation that maybe rationally we could say is not of their own making, but is so enmeshed that it is hard to see the complications of when you're a young person?
Well, you got to remember, too, that we are untangling, right, almost depending on the person, 20 years worth of ways of thinking. Can you imagine if we had an iPad before we exit out our parents' wound of like, I can be able to pick my parents, rather if it's depending on the race, the financial piece of it. I want us to be billionaires. I want to have 1 million dogs. Like if we had the ability to choose our lifestyle, none of us would have problems. But unfortunately, sometimes we're born into drug abuse. Sometimes we're born into alcoholism. And so when we're born into traditions that do not belong to us, right, we are automatically forced to accept all those things at birth, right? Until then, you become of this current age where you're like, drug abuse doesn't work for me. Alcoholism, you know, verbal abuse, physical abuse does not work for me.
Well, and it strikes me that in that answer, you've hit upon one of the really important tensions here, which is that when you're born into a situation like that or multiple situations like that, they become your norm because you don't know any other way, which is what creates the tension of this care conundrum, because it is a societal norm to take care of your parents, even though you have recognized that your relationship with your parents falls outside of that norm.
Right. And even then, for that piece, it's really important. You know, I like to do these several steps. One of them is acknowledging the truth, right? Because you can't stray away from truth. Right. You know, understanding that, hey, this was my life. This is what happened to me. Does it suck? Absolutely. But I have now the power and control currently to make a difference in my life. Even with the person that, yes, at the end of the day, do I love and care about this person? I do. But then also as well, maybe I'm not emotionally attached to that because of the trauma.
What about a situation where somebody has done a lot of work with a therapist like yourself? Mm-hmm. And reached a point where they feel like they can be in the hospital at the end of a parent's life, a parent who they had an abusive relationship with. And it feels important to them to say some things to that parent that they have not been able to say previously. Do you think it's important for them to express that, even though this parent is at the end of their life, maybe not in a place where they have the capacity to respond or give your client the kind of apology that they may be hoping for or the kind of open dialogue that they may have been hoping for?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a space, a few different ways that I personally would do it. One of them is writing a letter to that person. Oftentimes, the reason why I say writing a letter is because we try to pull everything off the top of our head. And oftentimes things get missed, right? And the best way of just writing it out is just saying like how you feel, talking about it. Of course, do it with your therapist if you are in therapy, because then they can help you do a deeper dive of why you feel this way. Because at the end of the day, this forgiveness piece is for you. It's not for them. Mm-hmm. Right? Because even when they officially pass on, guess who's still living and breathing, dealing with it?
Right. You know, it feels like we're talking about something that is scary to think about when it comes to our parents, which is like, are we allowed to center ourselves when we're so conditioned to feel like our parents have been so unselfish?
I think it's important to understand when you get to a certain point in therapy, you learn, and it may be a little plot twist here, is that everyone's operating at their highest capacity. How our mom and dad were treating us when they were younger, and again, not condoning it, not saying it's okay, but they're a product from the generation before.
You know, I asked that question in the spirit of, is it selfish to center your own well-being and emotional recovery in your dynamic with a parent. But it feels like what you just said is that what can be really impactful is actually to approach that conversation from a place of generosity, from a place of saying, I'm aware that the version of you that was you doing your best was informed potentially by generations
of bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not that you were willfully behaving the way you did, but nevertheless, it is the way you behaved and this is the impact it had on me. That's actually a very generous spirit.
It's being, let's switch it up. It's not selfish, it's being self-aware.
Ah. I feel like I'm getting free therapy on this, this conversation.
I am self-aware of my capacity. I'm self-aware on who you are as an individual. Mm-hmm. I am practicing self-aware that you may not show up for me the way in the capacity that I think I need you in.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes we get in a place of blame.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Again, it's not. I'm not saying that what people have done is okay. I'm not condoning it. But also, as well as I have to learn that it happened and I have to accept it. Now, what I choose to do moving forward, right? That's my choice. Mm-hmm. Rather, if it's again putting myself in this space of helping you throughout your end of days, or I choose to step back because this is still a little too much for me. That's my capacity. That's me being self-aware. And again, it doesn't make us selfish at all.
Mm-hmm. Let's say somebody's listening to this right now, and this is a situation they find themselves in. What would your message to them be?
Forgiveness does not change the past, but it enlarges the future. So I tell everyone that it's important to know that your story is real. It's important to validate who you are and to always be open to changing your life.
Joshua Johnson, licensed social worker and therapist. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. If you've driven at all around the valley, you've likely seen breeze blocks. Decorative concrete blocks in front of or on the sides of homes or other buildings. They're sometimes used in conjunction with more traditional concrete block construction, but not always. And they're not only aesthetic, they can also serve a purpose. And Phoenix is one of just a few places where you can find them. Taz Khatri is an architect and the person behind Taz Khatri Studios in downtown Phoenix. She spoke with our co-host Mark Brody, who started the conversation by asking when people started using breeze blocks as a way to build homes in the valley.
Well, it was when there was a huge housing boom in the 1950s, the post-war era, when there was a huge population boom, and therefore there was a huge housing demand. And really, that's when the block started to become popular because it was manufactured here, it was lightweight, and people could build homes really fast. So it had a lot of benefits. But before then, you know, the concrete blocks were really heavy. And there was this group of people here in the valley that actually figured out how to make them lightweight.
Hmm.
And that really expanded their use.
And some of these weren't just for construction. Some of them seem to be more decorative, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the fun part about these blocks is not only are they great for building the actual building, but they're also great for decoration, for screening things. And they're really great for the decorative block is like a really neat way to have both see-through material and a material that screens. So you kind of have a porous material, but it's also very solid. And it's an opportunity for builders to put in like a unique twist to a building. And it's sort of a delightful way to use block.
And am I right that in some cases these are used for shade or other cooling mechanisms, like sort of not necessarily inside the house, but maybe in the yard or in a patio or something?
Yeah, like I'm sure you've heard of the word breeze block.
Mm-hmm.
So the breeze block is really to let in breeze and daylight, but it is a really nice screening, privacy screening as well. So that is often how mid-century modern architects used decorative block as a screen and also just to let breeze in. So you have like a sort of a semi-screened front patio.
So it wasn't just an aesthetic thing. It also served sort of a practical purpose.
Absolutely. And that's sort of the beauty of it, you know, for modernism is, you know, everything has to have a purpose. And that's why these decorative blocks were, you know, purposeful so that modernists felt comfortable using them. But also it gave modernists a way to add decoration to a building.
So when you drive by them or walk by these, at least for me, I see them, it immediately screams like early 1960s. Is that sort of the era that comes to mind for you when you see these decorative breeze blocks?
Absolutely. I mean, though, that's when it was at its peak. And these days, you know, they don't really manufacture a lot of these decorative blocks. And so they kind of went out of fashion, unfortunately, even though they're fantastic, but they really do scream out like mid-century, 19th century, because that's when they were most popular.
When did they go out of fashion and why?
Well, you know, block has, in general, it hasn't gone out of fashion. It's just become much more expensive. So back in the 50s, labor was cheaper and manufacturing these blocks was cheaper. But now they're using different mixes and labor is a lot more expensive for masonry. So builders don't use it as much anymore. They use wood frame, which is like really quick and cheap.
Can you see a time when it sort of comes back and maybe either people are willing to pay for it or the price of the masonry goes down?
I'm not sure about the price going down, but I think, you know, there's definitely the longevity, the durability of the block. It's just a higher quality material, in my opinion, than wood frame.
Did you tend to see, especially the decorative block, was that mostly on homes? Did commercial buildings use it? Office buildings use it?
You see it a lot in homes, like as a breeze block, like in front of people's patios. But I think there are some really beautiful ways that people have used decorative block on commercial buildings or institutional buildings, like a lot of churches from that era, and just sort of maybe municipal buildings, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you see them at the state capitol, right? On the state house and senate buildings, they have sort of those, I think they're triangular type shapes that go from sort of above the first floor all the way to the top of the building.
Yeah, exactly. So people found ways to incorporate like creativity in these sort of building materials, which is super cool.
When these were sort of in their heyday, were builders like trying to outdo each other with how they use them or the designs that they were able to come up with for these blocks?
I think so. And I think they became like a real signature of some architects, you know, like Ralph Haver, he even designed one of the breeze blocks himself. So it became sort of a signature material for him.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Were there other areas outside of the Phoenix area that where this kind of design was as popular as it seems to have been here?
Well, the one place I can think of is Palm Springs. Palm Springs is like the haven of decorative block.
And a lot of mid-century modern design there too.
Yes. So it makes sense. So it's like the haven for really great mid-century modern design. So you can see a lot of great decorative block there.
But it never really caught on beyond those two places?
I guess not. I guess it's really unique to the Southwest. And I think it's a really unique asset that we have here in Phoenix that makes Phoenix a unique place.
So as an architect, do you see that when people maybe, you know, for example, buy a mid-century home and they're going to either tear it down or gut it and make it more contemporary, is there an effort for those homes that have this kind of decorative block to keep it or incorporate it in some other way? Are people thinking about this when they're renovating, you know, homes from the 50s and 60s?
I think absolutely people are thinking about it because they're so, those decorative blocks are so valuable from that era, especially because there aren't a lot of contemporary examples of decorative block. So people definitely, what I've seen is try to maintain those and not like tear them down and things like that. And then there's also an effort to keep the block construction of a home because that's also unique because contemporary homes are not going to be block. So I think that's something that people like to show off as well.
The fact that their home is actually made of the cinder block.
Exactly. So that's like a point of pride because it's unusual now. Yeah.
Interesting. And so like, do you find, I know that it's more expensive, but are there builders that do this? Like, is it ever done that a new home or a new building is built with blocks?
Absolutely. Oh, it's done all the time, especially like block is used a lot in education, in sort of like high use buildings where, because it's very durable. So like, you know, a kid isn't going to like kick the wall and like break it in, you know?
Might break their foot if they try. It,
exactly. So they use that a lot in schools. But in homes, like custom homes, homes that are like a little bit more higher end, you know, people will use block because it is a durable and beautiful material.
All right. That is architect Taz Khatri with Taz Khatri Studios. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Mark will be with you tomorrow morning with the Friday newscap and much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.